Sugatsia for my friends at Casper. Years of research, hundreds of tests, thousands of iterations. The result? The latest and dreamiest in sleep innovation, including the new mattresses from Casper. Casper has done it again with all new mattresses. Waking up with back pain? Introducing Zone Support, Casper's unique ergonomic system designed to keep your spine aligned when you sleep. There's something brand new called Airscape, engineered foam layers with perforations that help regulate your sleep temperature. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything to build the dream bedroom for every kind of sleeper. I've been sleeping on a Casper mattress for years. I swear by it. Most comfortable mattress I've ever slept on. Anytime they have new innovations, I am in on that. And as always, free shipping and free returns. And now Casper is offering free contactless delivery. And as always, free returns. Go to Casper.com. Use code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. That's code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms.
Thank you, everybody, for the positive feedback on the last few episodes that we've done with David Sampson. I like to take credit for it, but this has really been all David, the host of Nothing Personal. There's nothing that says he has to be totally honest with me. I don't really know why he's this honest, but man, do I appreciate it. David, thank you a million times over. That story about the bus obviously got a lot of publicity around social media channels. It kind of went viral, and it was a great story, man. You've been amazing.
Thank you, but why would you want a guest ever who's not honest? Doesn't that defeat the purpose of a conversation?
Really, honesty, there's not a lot in it. I've had conversations with Dan where he's like, why would this person lie to me? And I'm like, dude, curry favor. Do you not know why people lie? Like, people, sometimes lying is awesome. Don't you know Stugatz? Like, but you... I mean, sometimes it's not flattering, the truths that you tell, and sometimes it's very difficult for you. For example, the Larry Beinfest, Jeffrey Loria dynamic, you didn't have to answer that question honestly, but you did. I made you speechless. It was dramatic content.
I just think it's important that what you do and what I do on Nothing Personal, the whole point is to give people an inside look. And there's such a shroud of mystery over what we do, both in the media and in the sports world, in the front office, on the field, in the media. And there's so many people who just want to know. It's not that they're going to judge, which sometimes they do negatively or positively, but information to me, content is king. And why not just give people what they want? The Kinks said it right. Give the people what they want.
Love the reference. That's enough of a victory lap, because this is an episode that I've been looking forward to, a Montreal Expos episode. We will get to that, but there's some major developments on the MLB front. What do you make of the latest proposal that has some of the game's richest players earning contracts that Alfredo Amezaga wouldn't like trot out onto the field for? What can you tell us about the latest proposal? Is this just posturing, or is there now a legitimate chance that baseball won't return?
This is just negotiating right now. The players made a proposal that said the players have to take pay cuts. The owners said, if we're going to play baseball, the employees have to take pay cuts. I think it may have happened at your network where some of the top executives had to take pay cuts, but still put out the normal amount of content that they were doing. Is that not right?
In some respects, like Stugatz and Dan Lebatard and the whole Lebatard Enterprise is putting out more content than normal.
But while being asked to take a pay cut. So what the players got in the beginning in March was that if they play half the season, they get half of their salary. That's not a pay cut. And now what the owners are saying is, well, if we're only going to play 80 or 100 games, here is the different levels. And now things have just gone bat crazy. And the reason is that Scott Boras has gotten his players like Max Scherzer to send out tweets, which of course Max Scherzer didn't write. He's getting credit for writing this tweet, and I'll bet you dollars to donuts it came right from Boras, and it simply says, we shouldn't even respond to what the owners offered, which, by the way, you have to collectively bargain in good faith. You have to do responses and counters, so of course the union's going to counter. Boras is just such a blowhard that he has his players doing this, and it's creating more problems than it is solving.
David, what do you think happens to Scott Boras's commission? Because I had this question off air during one of these conversations. Does he still get the percentage on the contract he negotiated? Or does he have to also take a reduction in pay if Mike Trout and the likes of Mike Trout are making less than $6 million?
I feel like the light bulb just went off in your head. Of course, that's why Boras doesn't want anyone to get pay cuts, because when you sign a player, like he signed Gerrit Cole to that huge contract with the Yankees, and let's say it's $300 million just for easy. Let's say he takes 5%, which he does. That's $15 million that Boras makes off that. He's not getting that in year one. He gets 5% of each year's salary. So if Gerrit Cole was supposed to make $35 million this year, and instead he only makes $5 million, that's $30 million less. That's $1.5 million out of Scott Boras's pocket. Of course, he is an interested party. So that's what happens with his commissions. He doesn't waver, by the way, from his 5%. Never.
How do you think this ends?
It ends the way most things do, with tears and a journey. Sorry, that's from Shakespeare in Love. I don't know why I just did that, but that's the first time someone's asked a question exactly like that. How does this end? It ends with an agreement. I don't know that it ends with baseball, because there's still the health issue. So there's still the pandemic that has to be figured out, and whether any team sports can come back. Because baseball, the deadline, and here's a little news for all of us. Don't worry about June 1st or June 4th or June 10th to have an agreement. This is normal back and forth. The real deadline is August 1st for a season to start, not July 4th. So there's a lot of built-in cushion. And I think that it ends with hopefully baseball being played. But I'm more worried about the health side than the economic side.
Yeah, you've maintained that ever since we've started talking about what the plan is. You've hammered testing, health and safety of the players and all involved. And I don't really know, as more and more places start to reopen, we haven't hit that second wave yet. There are some encouraging signs, some surprising. I for one, am surprised what's happening in states like Georgia, where cases either go flat or down, when they were pretty brazen about how quickly they were reopening. So we keep learning more and more. And as we see other leagues like the Bundesliga in Germany, granted, not apples to apples, return with a level of success, you get hopeful that this could be something that could be done with the player's health in mind. Maybe not at the front of everybody's mind, which I'm sure is your objection, but it does seem like this is something that is at least possible, which is not something that looked at all possible back in April.
I'm hoping so. But at the end of the day, there's factors that we just don't control. And where baseball is different than basketball, where they're talking about going into a bubble in Disney World and doing just the playoffs, or hockey doing their 24-team playoffs but going to two different areas, you can't do that in baseball. That whole Arizona plan, I don't know if you remember that. I think it was like a year ago that they came up with having everybody just go to Arizona. You can't stay in one place for 6 months and do a season. It's just never going to happen that way. So baseball is in the toughest position because their season hasn't started, whereas basketball and hockey obviously can go right to the playoffs and everyone will be okay with that sort of play-in tournament type thing. You can't do that in baseball.
Yeah, we're already starting to see what's leaking out of some of the NBA players with this Orlando plan, Wide World of Sports Complex. Look, I'm a Disney employee. I love all Disney properties, but I don't think any of those resorts are really made for you to stay there for months at a time. You could go a little stir crazy if you're staying at the Wild World of Sports for more than 2 weeks, and players are already starting to leak out like this is not exactly bougie.
So they just talked about yesterday, and this was so funny to me, that they're now negotiating how many family members can actually come with the players, which, by the way, 50% of the players want no family members to come, period, right? Then when the families do come, if there's little kids, I want you to picture a little kid staying like at a Disney resort, but not able to go to the park. How exactly annoying will that kid be to the father, to the player, to the parents when he sees like Mickey out the window and there's nothing he can do about going to play with Mickey? I just can't even imagine it.
Yeah, you've essentially turned the most magical place on earth to Kissimmee St. Cloud. And I don't know. I don't know if Chris Paul and his family are going to be digging that, but we'll see. Okay, let's get into the Montreal Expos. How did Jeffrey Loria become owner of the Montreal Expos, and what year about was this?
So he started looking at, here's a little known story that actually is never I'm pretty sure I've never actually mentioned this, but you just reminds me of something from the beginning. Jeffrey Loria, he's going to be angry because he actually told me never to talk about this. Whatever. I'm not, it's fine.
In does the beginning, he subscribe? I'm sorry. Like, does Jeffrey Loria know what you're doing? Have you heard from Jeffrey Loria?
So he's a big fan of Nothing Personal, and he is aware that, I come on the show from time to time because he still has sources. So there's still people who call him and say, did you hear David say this or did you hear David say that? Many, many years ago, he had an opportunity to buy into the New York Yankees. That was the beginning of his life. And I was a little boy at the time, and he called me into his office one day and he said, how would you like to own the New York effing Yankees? And I was a kid and I was, well, what do you mean? Like as an owner? So you're saying I can meet Don Mattingly? Irony of ironies, right? And, he said, yes. It didn't happen. The deal didn't happen for many reasons, but it came very, very close, very, very close. So years later, 1999, I get a call out of nowhere that Jeffrey called and said, I want to buy the Montreal Expos. And I knew that they had been for sale because Charles Bronfman was the owner of the Expos. And then he got out and the main guy was a guy named Claude Brochu, who is a pretty famous guy up in Montreal. So I said, I'll be happy to help you. And I helped him with the transaction with one banker and one lawyer and me and Jeffrey. We were the only four people who worked on this transaction. And getting the Expos was the most complicated, difficult deal I'd ever seen, even though at that time I was only 31 years old. But the problem is no one in Canada wanted us because we were the Americans. We were the Jewish Americans. And that was an issue, believe it or not. Lots of anti-Semitism up in Montreal. Once we got the team, lots of, if you go and look, there are lots of newspaper cartoons with big noses and all sorts of horrible stuff that happened once we were up there. But we were the last possible choice to buy a team for Major League Baseball and for the owners of the Expos. Literally last. The first time we met with Bud Selig was at a hotel lobby in New York. Me and Jeffrey went to see Bud Selig, the commissioner of baseball. And he said, you really want to buy the Expos? This is what you want? And Jeffrey said, I want to buy a team. And of course, I'd prefer the Yankees or the Mets or a team in New York, but the Expos are for sale. So that's the deal that we're willing to do. And Bud said, well, you know, it's not going to be easy up there. They can't get a stadium and you're going to have to get a stadium and they don't draw very well. You're really going to have to figure out a lot of stuff. And Jeffrey sort of looked at me and I looked at him and said, well, fine, we'll do it. Jeffrey put in $12 million to buy the Montreal Expos. $12 million. That's it. It's unreal because the current owner of the Expos who ended up staying in as partners were the richest guys in Montreal. The Stephen Bronfman, this playboy, this rich son of Charles Bronfman, he couldn't come up with $12 million to keep Laurie and Samson out of Montreal.
Who were you guys bidding against?
That's the joke of it. That's why it was $12 million. Nobody, because we knew by going to Montreal and doing due diligence, there wasn't one of these rich Montreal limited partners who wanted to step up and be the general partner. Not one of them. And so they got totally screwed.
Greatest buy-in because through several other transactions, that $12 million investment essentially became $2 billion. It's a hell of an ROI that you got there. But was this a bit of a red flag to you and Jeffrey? Because if these wealthy people from Montreal aren't thinking that it's worth the $12 million, that has to signal that there are some major issues with this franchise.
Yeah, ego doesn't see red flags. So that was never in our mind. My mind is we'd move to Montreal and we would get a TV deal. We would get a ballpark built and we would increase the value of the Expos exponentially. Remember, contraction hadn't started yet. We didn't know anything about contraction. We thought it could work in Montreal. It's very close to New York, so Jeffrey could fly back and forth. This is pre-9/11 where you can get to a plane 5 minutes before it's leaving. I commuted for my 2.5 years in Montreal. I lived in a hotel.
Really?
Room 2512 in the Intercontinental is where I lived the entire time. Never bought a house, never bought an apartment. I had room service every day. And my biggest deal is that I got them to give me free pay-per-view, because that was before certain free things on the internet.
David Simpson, you scoundrel. All right. So David Simpson is now doing day-to-day operations. You guys have the expos. Let's fast forward the timeline a little bit to this is your baby now, and you start seeing all these problems firsthand. TV deal, not in great shape. This is your first experience, I imagine, negotiating TV rights deal. You're doing it in a foreign country, so I imagine there's all sorts of political dynamics, not just with TV, but also getting a stadium, right?
In a foreign language. Keep in mind that every memo that we wrote had to be in both French and English. The rules in Quebec are that it has to be in both languages, every sign, everything. So the first big meeting we had was with their sports network called Réseau de Sport. RDS is what it was called. And our TV money back then was bupkis. It was crap. And we wanted to bring in more revenue because Jeffrey wanted to get more players. That's why one of the first things we did is we signed Graham Lloyd to that horrible contract, and we traded for Hideki Arabu, which was a horrible trade.
Man, when his names.
It's when I first realized that we were going to become the Yankees North.
So I always heard, and it makes sense how excited Jeffrey was to have a small piece of the Yankees. I always heard Jeffrey Loria was a huge Yankee fan. That's true, right?
It's a dream come true, right? Because it reminds, everybody loves baseball because it reminds you of your father. So his father took him to his first ever game, and he watched all these great old Yankees. He saw them all in person. You get this sort of James Earl Jones feeling in your heart. And when you make enough money in your life, you know, a very successful art dealer, you say, I want to own a team and be a part of that exclusive club because I could never be a player. So now how about being an owner? The old story, right, about the worst day in a little Jewish boy's life is when he realizes it'll be easier to become an owner of a team than a player on a team. And I had that epiphany very young because I was always small, but some people have it later in life. So we go to a meeting with RDS, and I knew we had a problem, and I actually called Jeffrey after this meeting because he wasn't a part of it. And I also called Bob Dupe. We had to get a TV deal. We go into the meeting, and it was a man named Jerry Frappier. I'll never forget this meeting. This big, strapping TV executive. I'm going in. He was older and just had this aura of gravitas. And I go in there with my briefcase thinking I've got content for you and you better pay. We're going to need serious money. And back then, remember, the exchange rate was terrible. So I wanted American dollars, not Canadian dollars. 5 minutes into the meeting, he said, you know, David, just so you know, we would rather show curling on RDS than your baseball team. That was his opening negotiating stance. And I called baseball because I assumed they were kidding. It turns out he was dead serious.
It would rate better?
100%. Curling, wow. Canada rates better than baseball back then. Montreal was a disaster. No one came to games. They'd come to opening day and then never come again. There was no corporate sponsorship. We played in this old facility called Olympic Stadium, which was fun to be a part of, but it was old and decrepit and crappy. There was no radio deal. We had an English radio deal. Non-existent. So we put Dave Van Horn, a Hall of Fame broadcaster. He carried around a briefcase with him doing internet only radio.
Wow.
Back in the day before it even started, he had to carry his own briefcase and do it all. And we were mortified because he was such a famous, great broadcaster. It was just a horrible situation. We tried to get public financing. So I met with people both in the province of Quebec and also Ottawa, just everywhere, trying to get all this money. And meanwhile, these famous limited partners didn't do squat. They were so involved in the community. They wouldn't help. They wouldn't do a thing. All they did was complain.
All right. So I think we have a pretty good idea of your stadium situation, the TV, and already from a business standpoint, this does not look sustainable. What can you tell me about the actual team on the field, front office, through some of the incredible assets that you had? You had a lot of really good young talent on that team.
So I remember the first time we met the players was in October of 99. While the deal didn't close till December of 99, Bud Selig let us, me and Jeffrey, go to Philadelphia and meet with the Expos, because the Expos were involved in this crazy ownership situation where they really had no owner. They had no GM. They didn't know. Dave Dombrowski had left for He was gone from Montreal. He had gone to Florida. Then he left, was leaving Florida actually to go to Detroit after that. But they just had Jim Beatty was the GM. No one knew. Could they take on money? Could they have players? So we went in October and met the players. The first time I ever met athletes was in a ballroom. And now looking back on my career, I realized why they were so grumpy. They got off a team plane and they were asked to go to a mandatory meeting to meet a bunch of suits, which as I think about, of course the players didn't want to do it. So we stood there in front of the players and he said, "Hi, I'm Jeffrey and I want to buy this team and we're going to build this into a champion and just keep going throughout the season." And because it was the end of the season and starting next year, it's a whole new game. And it really was. And I mean, we brought in a couple guys and, but we had Vladimir Guerrero, who didn't know what we were talking about during the meeting. I had no idea at that time that he didn't speak English. We had just interesting guys. The manager was Felipe Alou, who was this crusty, grumpy, angry guy. And he had just had enough of the ownership situation. So from the minute we came in and met with him, we said we're going to keep him and that he would be the manager. At that time, we didn't know that we'd end up firing so many managers. You just don't know what you're going to be like as an owner or a president until you do it.
Yeah.
Felipe Alou, he was just angry all the time because he was burnt out. So you'd go talk to him and I was new. So I would talk to him after a game when something would happen and we'd lose and I'd ask him a question. And I was new and young and I admitted I changed over the years, but his response would be so disrespectful. Like, "I'm Felipe Alou. You're asking me why I made this pitching change? I made it because I wanted to make it. You sit up there and watch." That's what he would say a lot. "You sit and watch, I manage."
Oh my God.
So I learned early on that that's not how I would want a manager to be. That's not exactly team building.
Yeah. And more importantly, I think Jeffrey learned that that's not how he likes a manager to be. Okay. So how quickly into your time at Montreal do you guys start exploring other options like relocation, possibly selling? What is the first thing that comes up when you realize we might have made a mistake here?
Have you read the lawsuit? Is that why you're asking that question? Did you just make that? I actually need to ask you this right now.
No.
Did you just make up that question while we're talking?
Yeah.
So you have no prepared questions. You didn't do any research on any of the lawsuits.
Just no. What I remember about the Expos.
So do you remember the whole RICO lawsuit?
No.
Oh my God. I was sued for violating the RICO statutes. People thought that I was like in the mafia, that we had this whole conspiracy. We were sued, Mike, by the limited partners in Montreal. Me, Jeffrey, Bud Selig, and Bob Dupay for conspiring criminally.
With the mafia, which I found out, I went to Montreal for the first time about 2 years ago, and I had no idea how deep the mafia ties are in that city. It is a big organized crime city.
So
you got tied up in a RICO case?
In a RICO case. So my first thought when we got served this RICO case, and they did it with a big press conference, this is after we had said we were moving to Florida, and we took these Canadian limited partners with us to Florida. That's a whole long story. But these guys owned a company called Montreal Expos LP. They were limited partners. And one day we sent him a letter saying, "We'd like to inform you the name of your company that you have a stake in is now called the Florida Marlins LP." Because they had no say. We had taken over a majority of the team. So we had all the voting rights of the limited partners. We didn't have one thing that they needed to know about. So they just got a letter saying, "Hey, you know, we're giving you your season tickets, except they're now in pro player. So let me know if you want to come." And they were furious. So they sued all of us under RICO statutes. And it became this big deal.
I'm reading an article right now that says the allegation was that this was a well-thought-out two-year plot to undermine the organization so you can move the team out of Canada. And you were sued by your minority partners who you just told, "Hey, your company's name is changing."
So what's funny is you asked a question. You said, "When did you know?" That was the entire lawsuit. In a nutshell, the entire lawsuit was, and I was on the stand. I was the principal witness because I was involved in all of it. Jeffrey took the stand and just said, I don't recall. I don't recall. I don't recall. I don't recall. Yeah, I love baseball and I don't recall, which that's his job, right? That's what I'm saying.
I mean, I guess amazing optics, by the way, by doing that on the stand.
It's what it is, right? Yeah. And it happens to be true. Plausible deniability is one of the great legal principles of all time, by the way. So
thankfully I've never had to learn that from personal experience, but I'll take your word for it.
Wait, you've never been sued?
No. I mean,
oh my God, you haven't lived then.
I mean, well, let's wait till we put this podcast out and I'll get back to you as I'm reading more and more of these details.
So on the stand, the major point of the case was, when did you know that it wasn't going to work in Montreal? Because we believe and we're alleging that you came to Montreal knowing it wasn't going to work. You had this whole Machiavellian plan to sell the Expos, buy the Marlins, or just contract the team or move the team. So when did you know? And then all of a sudden you asked me that question. So I figured that this was a total setup and you're trying to get me to lie to you given what my testimony was.
All right. Well, do you remember your testimony? Go into one of your scrapbooks and if you want a refresher.
That is a library because you get the testimony, right? It's bigger than War and Peace. And the lawyer, by the way, who did my examination, my cross examination, was a guy named Jeffrey Kessler, who's a union hack job of a lawyer. Very popular, except he was simply horrible in this case. Mr. Sampson, is it not true that you knew from the beginning that you were going to screw over these men? No. Would be my answer, because when you're being cross-examined, you don't talk a lot. Like, you just answer the question yes or no. Could you please give us more detail when you knew it wasn't going to work? And so I would go in and explain all the different meetings I had and all the things I did.
Well, this TV exec told me that he'd rather air curling, and that was confirmed to me by people in Major League Baseball. So it was probably then that the gears started turning.
On the record, when we talked about public financing, well, you had a press conference announcing that you had a location for the new ballpark in Montreal. Yes, we did do an entire press conference. And yes, we put on a show for everyone because we had no financing done. What we thought was, if we put enough pressure on the public in Montreal by showing where the ballpark would be, we had designs made, we had meetings, we thought that that would get the public to pay up. But we were very clear, if the public's not going to pay for this ballpark, the economics don't work. And if we're not going to get some sort of currency equalization from baseball, none of it's going to work. But you don't know that going in, you hope for the best, but it's not like we didn't have a prenup. So that's what I would say to you now. I didn't know when we started that it wasn't going to work, but I certainly knew that it was going to be an uphill battle. And I knew that not one of these Canadians who sued us, not one of them wanted to step up and take the reins. So I had a pretty good idea, but it wasn't for lack of trying. It was for lack of succeeding that we moved the team.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it seems as though at every turn that you actually get a team, you're certainly not the first choice. Major League Baseball, they have a preference, and their preference is to sell the team to local businessmen. And in Montreal and in Florida, just nobody stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, say only, not first. It's not that we were the last choice or the first choice. We were always the only choice. Wow. And right, that's the word I would use. So, yes, Bud Selig did not want to have the Expos sold from his friend Charles Bronfman down to Jeffrey Loria. And then it caused one of Bud Selig's biggest regrets. Is that RICO suit where he was named? Stephen Bronfman, Charles's son, was one of the people who was suing us. And Charles and Bud ended up in a fight and their friendship got ruined over it. They ended up making up years and years later. And Stephen Bronfman, because Charles Bronfman tells Stephen what to do. It's not that Stephen said, I'm going to sue Jeffrey and David for RICO and Bud. Charles knew this was happening.
I'm still struggling to find out what the end game was of this lawsuit. There doesn't seem to be much of it. I'm reading a direct quote from your guys' attorney. Their case is as thin as ice. It does seem like a PR stunt, mostly.
This was all to cover themselves for letting a team leave Montreal and go to Florida and having their team sold to baseball and then eventually move to Washington. This was all about their standing in the community and them not wanting to take any blame. Because to cut to the chase, they lost the lawsuit completely. They didn't win one motion. They didn't win one objection. They didn't win. There wasn't one part of it that they won, but we had a fight and it took years to do. And the arbitration hearing that ended up happening, which lasted for weeks and weeks, happened after the World Series. And it was one of the great pieces of testimony where I got to say that we offered Marlins World Series rings to these Canadian partners, and every single one of them took it.
That is an amazing, amazing detail. I've always been curious how difficult it must be for franchises operating in Canada. Like in the NBA, the Toronto Raptors just won a championship. Are there any sort of accelerations to, for instance, I always figured it was different for, you know, Derek Jeter flying into Canada to play the Expos than it would be for me to fly into Canada just to see Montreal. What sort of logistical hurdles are there in just operating this team where every team that comes in outside of the Blue Jays is from a foreign country?
Yeah, back in the day, we had to fill out customs forms every time we came home from a road trip.
Oh, that's
and every time we left for a road trip and came into the States. So there were, you go through customs both ways. And that was just part of it. And so what the traveling secretary would have to do for the Expos, it actually would have to fill it out. And then we'd have to have each player sign a customs form. Remember the old paper customs forms?
Yeah.
There was no global entry. There was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest business issue, and the Raptors have this now, their revenue is in Canadian dollars and their expenses are in U.S. dollars, because the players for the Raptors are not paid in Canadian dollars. They are paid in U.S. dollars, which is why you have currency issues that are very, very significant when there's an issue between the Canadian and U.S. dollar.
All right. I still think that there's a lot of meat on the bone for the Expos, so we may extend this episode into two, because we covered some about your transition in the John Henry episode, but I want to stay on some of the issues. So you already know quickly off the bat that this is going to be very difficult. What is the first option for David Sampson and Jeffrey Loria? I think the first option was already, let me rephrase, the first option was definitely stay in Montreal, but you quickly realize that's going to be problematic. Relocation, selling it back to Major League Baseball, what is your ideal scenario?
What would have made the most money the fastest was to move the team. We wanted to move it to the New York, New Jersey area to be a third team in New York, New Jersey. We felt like we could get the votes from everyone but the Yankees and the Mets. And we also wanted to move the team into the Washington area, or we looked at Charlotte, because if we could negotiate a small relocation fee and get a ballpark built in those areas, which we felt we could, that would be the fastest way to get the asset higher than it was. So the first call was to relocate, but we couldn't get the votes. And it became clear that we would not be allowed as new owners. What happened was the other owners in baseball had just met us. And they said, we can't allow a guy to come in for $12 million. And a year later, all of a sudden, relocate a team to a great market that we can hold out for expansion and then get 1/30 of that expansion money. So I tried to get votes as a new guy in baseball, and I could not get votes for relocation. I had no traction at all. Bud had said no way. So I tried to go around Bud and go to different owners and presidents and see if we could get any relocation traction. And I knew immediately it wasn't going to happen. So then we switched over to selling that's where the idea came from that we talked about last week, of getting rid of the Expos and just buying another team.
Okay, so I had no idea that Major League Baseball entertained this third team in the New York area idea. You were looking New York, New Jersey, what, Trenton? How does one put out feelers? Do you reach out to local government officials? Because I imagine public financing is a large part of all of this.
So the first thing before you even get public financing is you have to see whether or not you have the votes. So we always did things in an order, and in baseball, counting to 23, which is a concept you and I have talked about, and I talk about a nothing person all the time. And I know that there was so much animosity toward the Yankees back in those days. And actually, these days too, that just exists. They were the big bad Yankees, and that's such a big market that there really should be a third team there. By the way, the current Tampa Bay Rays, if you ask Stu Sternberg under oath, the owner of the Rays, what he'd like to do with the Tampa Bay Rays, he would like to move it to the New York, New Jersey area. He'll never admit it to you, but he and I have talked about it, and I know it for an absolute fact that a third team up there would do way better than a team in Tampa or St. Pete, which is why there's no new ballpark there.
Can we stay here for a second? Because I got to figure, I always find it bizarre when expansion teams start in big time cities, like in MLS, New York City FC pops up, and that's more even intensely geo-targeted. Like, okay, but they play in New Jersey. This is truly, you know, the Bronx's team. I get all that, but in that area, you're either a Mets fan or a Yankees fan. There aren't just these people still trying to figure it out in your main demo for season ticket base. I still don't know who I'm going to root for. How do you crack that?
Yeah, remember though, in baseball, the key is your local broadcast deal. That is way more important than even gate. So the broadcast deal that you would get up.
I feel like an idiot.
No, not at all. I'm just telling the listeners is that that is not even a factor, is whether or not anyone will actually be a fan of my team. I don't care. I just have to have a TV deal and a ballpark, and the rest takes care of itself.
Man, it's so weird that it's that cut and dry. Like, people need programming for their network, and if we start winning, people will become fans because that's how this thing works.
How did it work in 1996 with the Panthers?
I mean, but there wasn't a competing team down here.
But no one had any interest in hockey until it all of a sudden came. It wasn't a big sport.
Yeah, but that's easier to explain because there's no other established team. Can you imagine if there was an NHL team already in South Florida and then 30 years later, another team comes down? Never mind the fact that we can barely support one.
Okay, let's talk football then, Mike. What if a second football team were in Miami? And unlike the Dolphins, who haven't won since I moved down here, maybe one playoff game since 02, have they won one playoff game since I moved here? I think that may be it.
Maybe one.
So what if another football team were here and it was like the Golden Knights in the NHL, where their first year they made it? I think they may have made it to the Stanley Cup in their first year. What if a new football team down in Miami, where the Dolphins have a stranglehold, made it to the playoffs and had a playoff run? Would people be going to those games?
I think with it depends on the marketing plan and who they target. Because I think most Miami Dolphins fans are really actually up in Broward and in West Palm. It's more of a white fan base, really. So it depends. The Tri-County area is so large that if you specifically target one of those counties and say, hey, this is your team, the stadium is in your county, I think it could work, especially if it's a Golden Knights scenario. After there's a whole generation of Dolphins fans that only know this franchise as a joke, despite the fact that they're one of the, you know, great crown jewels of the NFL.
People literally born who are going to college now, you're 100% right. They have
2000.
No idea.
December 30th, 2000 was the last Dolphins playoff victory.
That means that since I moved to Miami in 2002, the Dolphins have not won a playoff game. By the way, people born in 2000, they are now in college, or now they're home actually because of quarantine, but they're out of the house in theory. So you're right. That's an entire generation of people that the Dolphins are just not a successful on-field team. But where we were looking, when you talk about a third team in New York, New Jersey, you're talking about sort of the northern area where people choose between the Red Sox and the Yankees. The Mets really were not an impact. I was never really worried about the Mets because their fan base is much more Long Island based.
Yeah, whereas Long Island and Queens, right?
Right, whereas the Yankees are more on the Jersey side, if you will. So you go a little north of the Yankees, and you've got Red Sox fans that then blend into around Hartford, Connecticut, into Yankees fans. But if you plop yourself somewhere in the middle there, and you have a winning team, you have a huge broadcast deal because you have so many subscribers, and there's so many, the demographic is so great that it is a gold mine.
I mean, you look at, it's funny, you don't look at it as like they have two baseball teams there. You look at it as like they have like four regional sports networks over there, because every professional sports league has just about two franchises, sometimes three when you include New Jersey. They have the Nets and the Devils. So every market has pretty much more regional sports networks than they even have teams, and they're looking to fill out content. So that's the first thing that you're looking at. That's quite interesting. Did you ever have any public stunts like you had down here where you were wearing a cowboy hat when you were owning the Montreal Expos to leverage other cities and hold over the threat of relocation?
So it never got that far to go north to be a third team, because we met so much resistance, which I thought that it wouldn't happen. I thought people would want to sort of bring the Yankees off their pedestal. But I think that other owners got scared that if we allowed a team to encroach upon an existing geographical region, hey, today it's him, tomorrow could be me. So I could never get enough momentum for that. But in terms of relocating the Expos, we never did a public. The only thing public we did with these press conferences in French and English was saying, listen, no new stadium. The team will not be here. It has nothing to do with Loria or Sampson. Frankly, we were the violin players on the Titanic. It was going down long before we got there, but people have revisionist views of that. But we didn't threaten the way we did in Miami. Miami was a total threat. Hey, we're going to relocate. You better get a ballpark for us. In Montreal, it was far more dire, which was, listen, there's no shot here, and you know it from previous owners.
All right, quick question before we get into your review and we wrap up this week's episode. When exploring other relocation options, was another city in Canada ever in the equation?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No other place in Canada ever.
All right. Host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson. Every week he comes on this Local Hour podcast and he gives us a review. You really have two in the chamber because we didn't do one last week. So have at it. What are you reviewing for us this week, David Sampson?
So I'm doing this in very much more detail on Nothing Personal, I think, tomorrow. But I have to bring up a show to all of the audience because I'm obsessed with it. It's on my mind. I watched an entire series in 1 5-hour stretch. I didn't move. And it's a show called Dave.
Oh, I love that show.
Oh, my God. I heard all I was told by someone who I have great credibility with in terms of taste. He said, just watch Dave. I said, what's it about? Just watch Dave. So I got Hulu and watched Dave. It is worth the price of Hulu. It is about a Jewish rapper. He's a white Jewish rapper whose name is Little Dicky. By the way, watched the entire series, and I didn't know that that was a real person.
It's a real person. It's a real rapper that has real songs.
I had no idea. I thought that he was just a funny Seinfeld-like sort of Larry David sort of neurotic guy who was a great actor. I knew that he wrote the show. He produced the show. I didn't realize that it's all his guys and it's all real. It is brilliant. He's brilliant. It's hysterical. Some of the scenes in some of the episodes, when you put a hole in a picnic table, that's it. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. The series opens with him trying to explain a deformity to a doctor. And he goes through this entire thing. The opening shot, you don't know the character. You don't know anything. I was hooked from the first 3 minutes. Yeah. If you've got 5 extra hours, which in quarantine, just start, you won't stop. Dave is maybe the best series I've seen, boy, in a very, very long time.
Everyone that's actually given Dave a shot has nothing but the best things to say about it. And I'm right there with you. And the Seinfeld Curb Your Enthusiasm comparisons are so dead on. It's so observational. It has the sort of same pace to it. The fact that they're leaning into real life characters the way that Seinfeld and Curb does. It's a dead on comparison. And Lil Dicky is an unbelievable talent. And he's armed with the support of some of the most powerful people in Hollywood and the music industry, because Scooter Braun has an executive producer credit on this. And that's how you get cameos of Kourtney Kardashian that just pop in there. That's how his music career really got off the ground, because he has this music video with Fetty Wap called Get That Money, and Mark Cuban and Tom Petty show up in this video. And you're like, how is this guy that I'm just hearing about getting all these amazing cameos? It's because he's tied to Scooter Braun.
So did you know about him as a rapper before you decided to watch the show?
Yeah, I've known about Lil Dicky for, I want to say, 4 years.
And yet you still weren't interested in the show until someone told you to watch it?
I guess I had preconceived notions about the show, and I just wanted it to get like good reviews. And people, word of mouth got to me, and enough people kept hammering me with Dave. You know what a commitment it is to start a new show, and I burned through it in 2 days. It was incredible.
By the way, it's a perfect way to end this, because you just said something that many people think, and then they realize how silly it is, that you had this preconceived notion of something, and therefore you weren't willing to give it a try. And then you give it a try, and you say, why did I think anything possibly could be negative about it? Yet the next time, you go right back to the same preconceived notions.
Yes, and you'd think I'd learned my lessons, because a lot of people have preconceived notions about David Sampson, former Marlins team president, host of Nothing Personal, but he joins us on the Local Hour, and the episodes are better than you can ever imagine. David, thank you so much. I want to talk to you. Have you seen Uncut Gems on Netflix?
Yes, of course.
All right, I saw that last night. Let's do a little bit real quick, because I got to get the national show going here in a bit. Uncut Gems, the pacing of this movie gave me anxiety.
it's an anxiety inducing movie, right? Number one takeaway is that Kevin Garnett can actually act, which I was impressed with. Number two, Adam Sandler is an actor that is much deeper than Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison. He in this movie deserved an Oscar nomination. The anxiety with the score and the dialogue and the script makes it so I didn't know how it would end. And we're definitely, I guess we could spoil it. It's been out enough.
No, right? Don't spoil it because it just hit Netflix. It's number one on Netflix. So people are finding this movie now. I know I wanted to wait till it was actually on Netflix because I knew it was going to be on Netflix in May. So I waited.
It's well worth it. So we won't spoil it except to say it's a troubling movie. And obviously gambling and sports, it's very pertinent today. And this movie dives into it in a way that you will not soon forget.
Absolutely. And another cool cameo, KG is not just the only person that plays himself. The Weeknd actually plays himself in this movie and has a couple of good scenes too. So check out Uncut Gems. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit more as more and more people see this. We'll continue talking about the Montreal Expos. And I know the Expos are a very passionate topic for a lot of fans that actually love that team. So if you have questions about the Montreal Expos, hit me up on Twitter at Michael Ryan Ruiz. We will grill David Sampson for his second consecutive week on the Montreal Expos. And then we'll move on to our next topic. I'm thinking Jack McKeon for our next episode that's just centered around one topic.
Have I told you the toilet story of Jack McKeon yet?
That's a great teaser for an episode 2 weeks from now. David Sampson hosted Nothing Personal. Make sure to check out his podcast. Be back with you next week on Thursday with another episode on the Montreal Expos. Thank you so much, David.